I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Bill Richardson joins me now, the writer and broadcaster, recently published a collection, I Saw Three Ships, West End Stories. They are eight short stories linked because of their setting, Vancouver's West End neighborhood, set around Christmas, featuring characters from different walks of life. The stories speak so evocatively of that part of the city, about the people who have been drawn there over the last 50 years or so, and just how the neighborhood is changing, much like other areas of Vancouver. The book is sentimental in some parts, as it is melancholy. The characters are real in that they're people we know, people we've seen, people who live near us. I'll ask Mr. Richardson about these various characters and how this collection came about. Bill Richardson is an award-winning writer who received the Stephen Leacock Medal for Humor in 1994 for his book Bachelor Brothers Bed and Breakfast. He is likely best remembered for his years on CBC Radio, where beginning in 1992 he began as a regular contributor and guest host on Vicky Gabbro's program, going on to host programs such as You Like It, Richardson's Roundup, Bunny Watson, Saturday Afternoon at the Opera, and Sunday Afternoon in Concert, among other programs. John McLaughlin Gray said of Bill that his is one of the most distinctive voices in the country. The Twitter handle is at BILLRIC3602-8987. This book is published by Talon Books. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Bill Richardson. Mr. Richardson, good morning.
Thank you very much. It's so great to be here. I wish that everybody could see this amazing space you've got down here. I've rarely been in a place that is so chock-a-block with eye candy.
It's a mess, isn't it?
No, it's not. It's very, very artfully curated. It's like walking into the best kind of second-hand store or something, or curiosity shop. There's not a single thing in this room that I don't want to ask you about.
The thing is, I'm 37, and
you're a kid.
People who are older give you stuff, you know. They say, you know, you probably have better use of this than I will. Or they're downsizing, right?
They're downsizing. They've got the end in mind.
Sure, yeah. And so I'm keeping this stuff until my end is until that's at the fore. So I'm reading your tweets, and I follow you on Twitter, and I'm reading your book at the same time. This is right before Christmas. And the thing that I've noticed about your tweets is there is a tinge of the melancholy.
Is there? Well, there may be. I'm no judge of that necessarily. I think I am by nature. I don't know what humor it is that makes you melancholy. What's the melancholy humor? Is it phlegmatic? Maybe it's just melancholia. In any case, I have all my life defaulted a little bit to the Eeyore position.
Sure.
So I tend to be a little on the wistful side. But I recognize that in myself, so if I'm writing in that way, I try to indicate that I'm at least aware.
Yeah.
So that I don't come off as sounding absolutely pathetic or self-pitying.
The you are aware of, I guess, the time that you are in your life, right? I mean, I get that sense.
Oh, you're so subtle. You've divulged your age. I'll divulge mine. I'm 64. I mean, it's a long way from the end of the road. Or maybe
sure.
It's not. I mean, okay, I'll tell you. This is one of the curious things about being this particular age, is that it is a perfectly appropriate time to die. The obituaries are chock-a-block. I think I've said that twice now in our short conversation. It's one of those words I should watch out for. The obituaries are replete with people who have died around about this age. This is entirely to be expected. On the other hand, you could very easily go on for another 30 years. My family tends to be quite long-lived. Not my mother so much. She's thank God for that too. She's decreased the average a little bit, but in any case, it makes planning very difficult, right? Because for me, the last thing I want to do is not the last thing, but I don't want to run out of money. And as things now stand, I'm good until about 2023. And then I'm going to have to take the pill or something. But, so it is it's a strange time of age for that and for all kinds of reasons.
Yeah.
I'm very much aware of the diminishing of my powers and all that kind of stuff.
My mom had a friend who was she was 98.
Oh, golly.
And she was worried that she wouldn't have enough money still.
properly she would be. Who wouldn't worry about that?
And now I think she turns 103, I think, this year.
Uh-huh.
So she was probably right.
Okay.
She's doing fine, yeah. But, I mean, it's funny how you worry even at that age, you know. That. So you really don't know, do you? When?
Well, all my life I've been sort of aware of saving and that kind of thing. And now I look at what it's amounted to, and it's not much of a hill of beans. And again, I don't say this plaintively or complaining. It just happens
and
to be
no
the
regrets,
way it is.
Right?
No, rien, rien. No real regrets. In fact, no regrets at all. Yeah, but it is curious because you just don't know. You don't know when it's going to run out.
So you see, people think these are the so-called golden years.
Well, they are in lots of ways.
Yeah.
And they can be. I mean, it depends on who you are, I guess, and how you come out of it. I'm a healthy person. I'm a reasonably active person.
Yeah.
And so I've been lucky in that way. A lot of people get to this age and are not. And so, no, I mean, I never lose sight of how lucky I am in this world.
Some of the people in the stories in I Saw Three Ships
mm-hmm.
Are relatively lucky. Some are not.
Yeah. Well, who do you think is not?
Well, the some of the older characters.
Well, you know. Yeah, the book is about the relationships. It's about, one of the things it's principally about is the relationship that people in late middle age, which is, I guess, how I would still situate myself. Although, were I struck down on a bus leaving here, or by a bus, say, leaving here, I would be described in whatever story might be reported on that as elderly, for sure. An elderly man was hit by a bus on Fraser Street. But these are stories about people in their late middle age. They're all childless, and they're kind of barren in some ways. And they have parents who are still alive, their mothers in each of the three cases. And their mothers are, of course, if you are in your late 50s, early 60s, your parents are of necessity going to be quite elderly, properly elderly.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a relationship they have with them. It's about that funny transference of responsibility that comes along when you become your parents' caretaker.
And these are people, the characters in throughout the book,
mm-hmm.
these are people you've seen, right? These are people that are neighbors of yours. That
not precisely, no. To some extent, I'm certainly in there. My experiences are certainly in there. People I've observed are certainly in there, but they're very much hybridized in that sort of way. Yeah, I don't take wholesale from individuals' lives. Overheard conversations are fair game.
but what does it say, though, if people will read this book and recognize, say, themselves in it?
Well, I think it just means that the experiences that are being described there are pretty usual. They're just life experiences. They're what you're going to encounter if you're lucky enough to get to a certain age and to have parents who are still with you.
And that's the thing too. I mean, no matter what happens in whatever particular story, there is a bit of a hopeful note, I think, for most of them, isn't there? That whatever happens, I mean, it is enough. It is okay.
Yeah,
things
no
will be
dies.
Fine, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, in fact, some people do die.
We all do, right?
But, yeah, it's a bit of a truism to say so, but I think, well, truisms are truisms for a reason. That reason would be that they are in some way true. And I do think that there is something about writing that is essentially optimistic because, I don't know, apart from anything else, it imagines the possibility of a readership. Well, that's a pretty quixotic idea when you think of it.
Yeah. And what else do we have other than optimism, I suppose, especially?
Oh, lots of things. Starbucks.
Sure.
Gin martinis.
Well, there
happy
you go.
Hour.
There you go, yeah. Are you by nature nostalgic? Because there's a sense of the sentimental throughout the book.
Now, what do you mean by sentimental? I don't mind sentimental, but
yeah.
I think people often... It's a word that is used to impugn a lot of the time. I'm not denying it.
Yeah.
And I suppose that I do have a kind of sentimental side to me, but
it's
more than balanced by a character that is marbled with cynicism as well.
Sure. Yeah, it's not a mod. I didn't get the sense of the maudlin as I was reading the book, but it... like, I grew up in this neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
I've been to the West End growing up, sure. But it's not a neighborhood that I knew. And yet I can be nostalgic for places that I've never been to.
Well, I felt a kind of nostalgia walking to your studio today, and I took a wrong turn on your street, and I went west rather than east.
Okay. Yeah.
And no big deal. But I passed by a number of houses which have development permit signs around
them. Oh, sure, yeah.
And I felt, although they're not houses I know, it's not a neighborhood I particularly know, although I lived here for 40 years, and I felt an immediate sense of something like nostalgia to see these places that have about them so much history and, it must be said, so much charm and so much of something that, quirky is a bad word. Quirky is a word that gets used sometimes to describe these stories, and I'll put up with sentimental, but I don't put up easily with quirky. Mm-hmm. And to see, you know, the evidence that all of this stuff that is unique and eccentric and a little bit out of time, that is so heterodox in a way, is going to become part of the other, the homogenization of the
That's
place
like
that we live in.
Going up and down Cambie, say, from King Edward up to 41st.
Up and down Cambie, of course, and increasingly going up and down Fraser is going to be the same kind of deal. But I say this, on the other hand, I think I make this point in the book in the introduction. I observe it, but I don't really mourn it. It's a city changing,
sure.
and in some ways it's a city doing what a city needs to be doing. I'm sure that when Haussmann was bulldozing Paris in the 19th century, people were saying, "My God, mon Dieu, we're going to miss those slums,"
yeah.
And probably they did for a while, but now we have Paris. So there you go.
The village like feeling that is in the West End, mm-hmm. though, that's still there, isn't it?
To a certain extent. I live in the neighborhood called Waad, W-O-D, west of Denman, and it still feels quite village-like in its own way. There's also Soda, south of Davie, which has that feeling about it. And even as places come down and as new places go up, apart from anything else, it's one of the things that city planners do to brand a neighborhood,
sure,
is to call it a village, right?
Waad and Soda, are those... terms
so does south of Davie, Waad is west of Devon.
Yeah, so were those marketing things? Or?
No, it's just what people in the neighborhood
say.
Okay,
yeah, there you go. Yeah. So it is the pressure of development, that's throughout the city.
Yeah, of course.
So what do you worry about in terms of what will change?
I don't really worry about anything. Change is going to happen. So I'm not losing any sleep about it. I mean, privately there are certain things that I mourn, but there's a beautiful poem by James Merrill, and of course, did I mention I'm 64? I'm forgetting the title of this poem, but it describes that phenomenon, and there probably should be a word for this in English. Probably the Germans have a word for it, where a building comes down and you walk by the building and you notice the vacant lot, but you can't for the life of you, even though you pass by that building 1,000 times, actually remember what was there.
Yeah.
So I question, not exactly the genuineness of that feeling, but I don't think it's something that we want to get too caught up on. You live in a place and the neighborhood becomes part of your memory. You can think of things that happened here, things that happened there, it will change. It's what cities do. It's what we're meant to do. It's what they do best. And so I don't get too lie down in front of the bulldozers about anything.
So if one lived in say, the building or one of the buildings uh-huh. that is depicted in the book,
right?
The memories of those people, that's visceral in a way, isn't it?
Yes, I suppose it is. Certainly, that of course, is the great tragedy when people are displaced by construction. But yeah, the buildings in which we live inform us. The people we meet there inform us, just as they inform passersby.
Now, you mentioned a moment ago that you've lived, say, 40 years in Vancouver?
Yeah, I moved here in longer. I moved here in 1978 to go to UBC. I went to the School of, then it was called the School of Librarianship. It's now called the School of Library, Archive, and Information Science, I think. I may have that wrong. So I graduated from there in 1980 and became a librarian, and then I sort of moved along my as I laughingly call it, my career path, mercury-like, helter-skelter here and there.
How much time do you spend in Manitoba?
I'm there, well, I'm not sure how long this will be the case, but I've been there kind of half the year for the last 6 or so years. I moved back, I grew up in Winnipeg, I went back to Winnipeg in 2012 when my father became ill, thinking it was going to be for a couple of months, but he wound up living for 2.5 years, so I stayed there during that time. At that time I bought a house in the country west of Winnipeg, and that's where I have been spending about half the year, the summer half.
So does it still feel like home when you're there?
It feels like home because I've made it my home, but where I live has no family connection to me, which always surprises people who are there. In the main, the people who live in this little village have lived their whole lives there, or they were born there, raised there, went away and worked and then came back. And latterly, it has been happening more that people are finding nice and not so expensive houses and relocating there. It's a way of managing a retirement or a change in income. Mm-hmm. And this is a cause of some puzzlement to people who are there. I don't want to make I hear myself saying that, and I feel like I'm doing something that's diminishing or trying to make people quaint. They're not quaint. They're great, lovely, engaged. It's an intelligent community. It's mostly an agricultural community, and it's fascinating for me because it's so different from what I grew up with, and I've been made to feel very welcome there. But I am also very aware that if you're not from there, you're never really from there. Yeah. And I'm okay with that.
But you feel most at home, say, in the West End, in Vancouver?
I don't really know where I feel most at home anymore. I've never been somebody who really feels... I'm restless, and I've never really felt, I don't think, at home anywhere. I do feel at ease there. Yeah. Of course, I've lived there for so long. It's not the only place I live in Vancouver, but I've lived there more than anywhere else and for longer periods than anywhere else. I'm restless and I move. I get bored, I suppose, in a way, and I want to shake things up, and I think the easiest way to do that is by changing address.
Yeah.
And probably I've always thought that by doing that, I'll change some troubling aspect of personality, and of course that's not going to work. The baggage comes with you, as we know.
Yeah, you told Grant Lawrence recently that you want to be buried in Winnipeg or in Manitoba, is that right?
Yes, I think this is in my will. It says, it specifies the little graveyard. It's a country graveyard, very out of the way. It's not a place that anybody would ever visit, but I don't know enough people who would come and cast flowers on my grave or shed a little tear at the tombstone. But I love visiting graveyards and cemeteries, and one of the things that I like is just reading the tiny brief stories on gravestones of people that I've never met and will never know and whose families I don't know. I find it a great kind of goad to imagination. I've certainly, not in this book, but elsewhere, I've taken names from cemeteries from time to occasional time. So I think that's one of the things that I like the idea of. I think it'll probably be my only legacy. And that somebody might... Is it Yeats? There's some Yeats thing. Oh, God, this is the moment in the interview when he quotes Yeats. The horseman passed by thing. Look, something on life and death. Horseman passed by. Anyway, just that. Some kind of inscription that's going to make people stop and wonder, possibly smile. Who knows? You know, it's a little gift.
So the thing that I was, when I read that, I guess it was in the Courier, the interview you gave Grant.
Uh-huh.
Because you've lived here for so long, I wonder if you want to be buried at that place.
Do you know how much it costs to be buried here? You can't.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
It's impossible.
Okay.
Oh, my Lord. No. Couldn't do it. And that place happens to be one that I love.
Yeah.
My partner will be buried in a family plot in Victoria, and I'm not going to be there. So there's no particular reason for me to want to, I don't know, perpetuate that alliance beyond this life. I'm sure he'll be heartily sick of me by then in any case. So I might as well do it in Manitoba. And, yeah, I think that's what I'll do.
So it is a connect.
I just like the idea of full-body burial as well. It's going to be inconvenient if it's, like, January.
Right, yeah.
I'm not sure how they do it.
Yeah.
I think they keep you on ice.
What was that movie recently where they had to wait several months to bury the Manchester by the Sea?
When the dad died,
they had to wait for because the ground, I guess, they're in Massachusetts is...
I don't remember that. You know, I started watching it, and all I remember is there was a lot of boat action, and I get seasick easily. I think, I wasn't so far. I know it was a great movie and everything, and great performances, but wasn't my cup of tea.
How do you spend your time other than when you say writing or working?
I don't know.
Not very much.
I stare into the middle distance, wait for the end. I'm not a very social person. I don't have a very active social life. I see my partner. We go to movies and have dinner, and I check in with friends. And I don't have a lot else that I really do. I read and I write, and that's pretty much it for me.
So some people would find that curious. Someone that they grew up, say, reading or listening to on the radio.
Would they?
I would think so.
I don't know why.
I mean, some people, because I've been planning this for a few weeks now, and whenever I'd mention it to people that I'm about to talk to you, they would light up because they remember you on the radio, or they've read something that you've just written. Like you wrote about the Strait, for example, on the TAI recently.
Oh, yeah, well, that's so, yeah.
And so some people, a number of people lamented that you are not on the radio today, or not read regularly.
Oh, well, they don't work for the CBC then, where there's not a lot of lamentation going on that count.
Well, politely, you're a bit of a pain in the ass, were you, for management?
Oh, no, I don't. No. I've never been. Well, maybe I was.
I read that piece that you wrote during the strike.
I'd forgotten about that. Well, that I may have been a little bratty in that case, but that,
rightfully so, though, I think, especially what you had to say about
it. All I remember about that, I remember that it was 2005, and that they, so yeah, it was a lockout, and they kept on, they were locking us out, but they were using our work, and they had every contractual right.
Mm-hmm.
But I got to say, it just pissed me off royally for some reason, and that was when I took this cater waiter job, and wrote about it, but in any case, I was eventually when I was invited to return, I declined the offer, and then about 2 years later, they asked me if I wanted to host Saturday afternoon at the opera and Sunday afternoon concert, as then it was called, the show that Paolo Pitapello hosts now, and he's brilliant. And Ben Heppner, also brilliant, hosts the Saturday afternoon at the opera show. Anyway, it was fine for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, and then it just wasn't. It became a bad piece of casting, and it was time to go, so...
I guess people, I mean, you do realize that you're beloved not only in this town, but across the country.
I don't know about that. I think that there's, thank you for saying so. If that's so, of course, that's a huge honor. But radio memory is short memory. I remember there was, in the hallway of the building, the CBC building, around about the time, I think I was there so long that I was there either for the 50th anniversary or just after the 50th anniversary. And they produced this poster of kind of postage stamp size photographs of various worthies who had been on the air people at CBC.
Right.
And although I, by that point, had been a kind of devoted listener to the service, as I am still, for about 20 years, I hardly recognized a single one of them. And I remember thinking, aha, pay attention to this because this is the way it will go. And it's very easy when you're in that kind of situation. If you have the sort of personality that resonates to massage, as I guess I do, that is ego massage, then why else would one do any of this stuff? It's all a kind of showing off. Loathsome, really, when you think about it.
but that piece that you broadcast last year about taking a job as a dishwasher.
Right, that was on the Sunday edition.
Yeah, I mean, when Sunday morning, people were posting that on Facebook and sharing that on Twitter, and
well, it was nice of them, but that was maybe a slip in judgment doing that. When I started working as a dishwasher, I was working at Whole Foods, and I'd promised myself that I wouldn't write about it because it seemed like such an obvious thing to do, and like such a bid for what? I'm not sure exactly. Sympathy. I knew that I would be dubious about my own motives, and I wasn't looking for sympathy. I didn't require sympathy. Well, I'd kind of bottomed out, and I needed to do something that would get me out of my apartment and out of my head, and that was my main motivation for doing it. I like getting paid for it too. That was great, but it worked. It was like, okay, here we go. This is my antidepressant without pharmaceuticals. And that was really what I wanted to, that was the story that I really wanted to tell, is that because for a lot of people who are my age, I think, and whose professional circumstances have changed for whatever reason, either through retirement or because you get like downsized out of the picture or declared redundant in the workplace, whatever it is, it's unsettling. You lose your identity, and it can become very, very depressing. And I was depressed, not just for that reason, but I thought, right, just to take charge, to do something, and in a way, to do a job that requires you to get over yourself a little bit. Frankly, I had to do that. I was working in my neighborhood, and it did concern me a little bit that there I'd be in my filthy apron hauling this great massive bin of organic matter out to the bin, and somebody would say, "Oh my God, has it come to this?"
Or you used to be someone.
You used to be someone. Yeah. That was what one of my supervisors said to me. I heard you used to be someone. But I did get recognized occasionally by people in the neighborhood. I used to do stuff for Knowledge Network, and the great thing about radio is that it's, well, less so now because there are cameras all over the place. But back in my day, it was essentially anonymous. It almost never happened to me that I'd open my mouth in McDonald's or something and say "Big Mac, please," and somebody would say, "Oh, are you?"
Yeah.
That almost never happened. But now it's a little different. Anyway, when it did happen, it was just fine. And when that did happen, it was just fine, was a great kind of relief to me. And it also meant, right, you need to understand that absolutely nobody else in this world holds you in the same regard that you hold yourself. There's not one other person in this world who spends as much time thinking about who you are as you do yourself. We all know this, but it's easy enough to forget it. It's a lesson of coming out, I think, in some ways, too, that... I don't know if it's still the same. I think arguably it's different now. But I remember coming out in the late 70s, and there weren't a lot of public examples that people could say, "Oh, well, you're gay, so that's like, you know."
Mm-hmm.
And I fretted and fretted and fretted about what people would think, what my family would think. And in the end, they thought nothing. They said, "Well, whatever, let's get on with it." That's not everybody has that kind of experience.
Yeah.
I understand this, but I think it's pretty usual. And the lesson of it is, if a lesson is to be drawn, or a lesson to be drawn, or a lesson of it, a lesson from this, if a lesson is to be drawn, is that no one spends as much time thinking about your, say, sexuality as you do. So. It's been good. I just started a new job. I worked my first shift last night, 5 to 1, and it was bloody, bloody hard. Yeah, that we're in Dine Out Vancouver season.
And it's the worst time to eat, isn't it?
Three sittings in this big restaurant, and it was just this sort of nightmare. a relentless parade of filthy dishes and kitchen stuff. And but you know what? 1 o'clock came, and it was done, and it was clean. And I was exhausted, and I thought, still, you know, I did it, and it feels okay.
The thing that I enjoyed about the piece was that because I have a regular job, if you will, you know, apart from this. And, you know, I work 40 hours a week. And
I didn't know the other. What's your regular job?
I work for the company that owns the local towing company.
Oh, okay, okay.
So it's you know, it's office work, essentially, which I, you know, it's easy enough that I don't have to think, and it pays the bills, right?
Yeah.
And I get to do this during the day and you know, hang out with people like you and talk about books and stuff. So I find that, you know, having that balance in one's life just you know, interesting. But the value of work itself, of hard work especially, that's what a lot of people said that they appreciated when you said what you did and wrote what you did.
Right. Well, it does have, I guess it has a value. I'm not in a position to, I don't know, judge that in a way. It brings me, I don't love it in an unreserved kind of way.
Sure, sure.
It's a horrible job.
Yeah.
It's a horrible, horrible job. But it still does what I wanted it to do, get me out of my house, get me out of my head. And it's, although I'm not a very social person, I do like kind of being around people. And a kitchen is a very social environment. It's not a place where you have deep conversations with people, but you're around people at least. And in the restaurant industry, for the most part, they're millennials, of course, and or Gen Zs, and so that's great for me because I don't have another way of being around young people. I mean, I just spent 3 months at the University of Manitoba doing a writer in residency, and pretty much that was open to people in the community at large, and pretty much everybody who came to see me to get my sage counsel was somebody who was about my age. Nothing could have surprised me less, and this was so. But I was living on the campus. Look, I'm wearing my University of Manitoba hoodie. It's my swag from, or schwag, as we say in Manitoba. my only regret was that I didn't get enough chance to be with young people. So that's the other thing. I mean, just to have that kind of energy and to see the sort of look of bewilderment on their faces when this old man turns up to wash dishes. I think maybe they think, oh God, what did he do? What did he do to earn this dubious distinction?
But it does change the environment for them. I would think that they would find.
Oh,
some...
I don't think it does particularly.
No?
Again, nobody cares. Once they take one look at you, they go, "Oh, that's different."
As long as you get the job done, I suppose, right?
Yeah, that's different. Yeah, and I try not to play the age card when I fuck up. You know.
Yeah. Speaking of fans, beloved as you are, I'm sure you have gotten peculiar pieces of fan mail over the years, have you?
No, well, maybe the odd one here and there, but that would be a pretty rare thing.
I love the letter that the one character writes in the book to a particular personality.
Right. Well, that's a story called Sinners Reconciled, and that was one of the stories that was written for the Georgia Strait, and it's the story of Bonnie is the name of the character. The three principal characters are Bonnie, Philip, and Gary. And they are the people who are in late middle age, and they're the people who are stumbling, and each of whom has care and custody in a way of a mother. And in Bonnie's case, her mother is Gloria, and Gloria has died, and Bonnie is writing a letter to Peter Zosky, which certainly dates the story. It's from 1999. Zosky had retired by that time, and so she's writing to him in his retirement to let him know that her mother who was his great great fan has passed away, and so one of the shows that I hosted at CBC was called The Roundup, and it's called Richardson's Roundup officially, but we never called it anything but The Roundup, and it traded on listener letters, and I did notice over the 7 years, I guess, that I did the show, I thought that there was a sort of evolution of something like literary style, where people were writing, as I imagined, and again, this is kind of vain, but I think it was probably true, they were writing with my particular voice in mind.
And wanting to be read on the air, I guess.
Yeah, well,
right?
Yeah, and why would you write to a radio show if you didn't want to be read? Yeah. So And they were always great stories. So that's really what that letter is kind of based on, is that experience, yeah.
The other thing, the stories, a lot of all of them, I guess, are set around Christmas time.
Yeah, they are. They were all written as occasional stories, in the sense of written for an occasion, and Christmas happened to be that occasion. Although, as I keep on saying, the fact that they're set at Christmas is, in some ways, the least important thing about them. It is just a kind of prop in the stories. Likewise, the neighborhood. Likewise, the West End. They could be anywhere. It happens to be that that's where they're all set. And when I went to choose the stories for the collection from the roughly speaking 20 or so that I had to pick from, that was one of the reasons I picked them, is because they seem to be linked in a way through the neighborhood. And then as I was working on them and revising them, I tried to open them up in their interiors so that those three characters, Bonnie and Philip and Gary, who become the magi of the stories and the ones who are stumbling, kind of slouching towards Bethlehem, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Wait, another Yeats quote. I've got a Yeats infection.
There you go, yeah. So I read this before Christmas time. The book came out, I guess, in the fall, and so I bought it November, I guess. And so I was reading it.
Thank you for doing that, by the way.
I appreciate it. The story's in it. So I'm reading it, and I'm sort of preparing myself for Christmas and realizing the things I hate about Christmas and the things that I like about it.
Uh-huh.
And...
Did you grow up observing Christmas?
Sure, yeah. I'm Filipino, so we're Catholic, and we have to do that, I guess. But as I've gotten older, you know, you drift away, and, you know, you do things that, you know, you want to do instead, like go to the movies at Christmas rather than, say, Mass.
Right.
And I don't know, for you, is Christmas something that you don't like?
It's not that I dislike it. When I was a child, certainly, again, I think this is probably true. I wish I had one original thing to say, but I don't. For most children who grew up in Christmas-observing families, as mine was, we were a United Church. Of course, it's charged with everything that's magical. Man in red suit flies through air, comes down chimney. And I loved the ceremony, and I loved the music, and I loved all that kind of stuff. And then as I grew older, you know, like a lot of people, I simply grew away from it. And I think a lot of the reason I grew away from it was that I just couldn't find myself having enough interest in the narrative that sustains the thing. I didn't believe. Yeah. And I didn't have the patience in a way to come to some kind of interpretive stance that would make me more tolerant of it. And I just grew more solitary as well. So, also, working in radio, when I was active in radio, and this is less so now because, I got to thank God, we're more mindful of multiculturalism, and the people who work there are themselves more representative of the population. When I was there, it was a pretty white place. Anyway, I think we all felt a kind of obligation to make some big deal of Christmas, even though we were calling it the holidays by then.
Mm.
And I got kind of sick of it. Anyway, you know what? It comes along now. I observe it with a kind of wry fondness. I hate the music.
Really?
Well, I used to love the music, and I still, in some ways, do love the music, but it's the inevitability of encountering it every place you go.
Walk into a bathroom and you can hear it in a restaurant or something like that.
With the one exception of "Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas," sung by Judy Garland.
Right.
See, that's the great thing about that song, is that it does have that definitive performance. There can be no other. No one should try.
Yeah, that's a song that says a lot, because it's wistful. There is that sense of melancholy, if you will, regret. There's a wonderful line in the book, "What if is a country that will absorb you if you wander too far in? It's nowhere you want to get lost. Nothing grows in the land of what if." And I was just thinking...
Ooh, that's good. Who wrote that?
Yeats.
Well, do you know what? It is a little Yeatsian. It is a little, this is no country for old men. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. But you wrote it, and as you mentioned, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, it has that sense of the person singing it. There's a hell of a lot of what if in it, isn't there?
Well, there is. I can't remember the exact story about the way those lyrics were rewritten, but they actually did, in their first iteration, they actually did allude specifically to death. And I mean specifically to we might die,
yeah.
And all this will be over. They changed them because I guess everybody thought, that's a bit of a downer. But even so, it does have that kind of. There's a sense of something fatalistic about Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. Yeah, till that's no, we'll always be together if the fates allow. I forget. I'm sorry. I'm blanking a little. On the exact text, but it is a very there is a quality of melancholy about it that that I like, and also kind of here we go again, nostalgia. But it does not seem to me to be sentimental.
No.
Yeah, it's leavened rather the sentimentality, but the potential sentimentality becomes more astringent because there's a kind of acknowledgement of there's in that song there is the possibility of ending and mortal ending.
Well, through the years we all will be together. Yeah. You know,
there's that hope. If the fates allow.
Yeah, so there you go. There's the hope that's...
Yeah.
but that line, though, the what if, is that something that has come to you easily, though? Because, I mean, we all get mired in it, in you know.
No, I think the truth is I remember writing it. I wrote it when I was revising the story. The story is one about a guy who gets skunked with his dog on Christmas Eve and therefore can't go back to his building. He becomes temporarily homeless as a consequence of this thing. And I had introduced I introduced into that story a character from a previous story whose death is tragic, I decided that I would make this character, this skunk character, his brother, and I was writing about their estrangement and setting this guy, the one who gets skunked, in a therapist's office, and that's when that line comes up. So in a way, it was really just writing about what you might hear a therapist say. I didn't intend too much by it. That's the truth. But if somebody's reading it and finds something in it that is meaningful to them for whatever reason, then that's what that's all about, right? You just never know.
Yeah.
You never know when you're writing something and you put it out there what somebody's going to respond to and what they're not.
I mean, what does it feel like when someone says to you that they found that particularly wise or that they're useful even in their own?
Well, it would be unique for one thing because certainly no one's ever mentioned it before. I'm glad. I'm happy. It feels that's good to know.
What is it like for you to write? How do you write? Do you write?
What's it like for me to write?
Yeah.
Well, these days I'm not doing it that much. I'm poking away at a few things. But when it goes well, by which I mean when you come to the end of the day and you think, oh, there's something there that's that maybe there you don't need to throw away. That's a good feeling. It feels productive. It feels useful. The best is, this doesn't happen so much anymore, when you have those moments of time being elsewhere, often it's just a slog for me.
Yeah.
I probably different for other people. You know, a good thing about writing is that it's not like tennis where your best days are behind you when you're 24. People write brilliant, brilliant stories and novels when they're very young, often. But, and I think there is, I love reading, writing by young people.
Do you think you're a better writer today than you were, say, 20 years ago?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. But the thing is that you don't have to give up the expectation that you're going to get better. Or at least more steeped. I don't know if anything's better or not, but
is it easier?
No, not for me.
Yeah.
No.
Do you crack yourself up when you're writing?
No, I'm not. I'm never. Not to be disingenuous, I'll write something and I'll be aware that somebody might find it funny, but it's never ever been my first concern.
Well, what is it like to know that people will read this and laugh along and
great, lovely,
yeah.
Perfect.
Who makes you laugh?
Oh, golly. Well, I have said before, and I always come back to it, that I think one of the it's not humor exactly. It's more Mavis Gallant and Alice Munro, who are there. We go, the old school writers.
Yeah.
That marks me as somebody of my generation, I guess. They come up in that story about Peter Zosky as well, Alice Munro especially. But I read them, and I inevitably, if I don't laugh out loud, I'll at least smile very widely at the wryness and at the irony and at the keenness of the observation and just at the felicity of the language. It's that combination of insight and observation and diction. Just the choice of phrase that gets used to describe that I find so incredibly appealing.
Yeah. It makes me want to read more when I read.
You're
your
surrounded
book.
By books in this
yeah.
weird little space here. Books and political buttons.
Does it make you want to clean?
No. If you have some dishes, buddy.
The I was going to ask you what's next for you, but I guess everything is next for you, isn't it?
Well, what's next for me is another 5 to 11 shift in the pit. We'll see how that goes. And then I'm working on a collection of poems for kids, middle grade, ages 9 to 12, more or less. And so that's well underway. That's supposed to get published in next year, 2021.
Here's a dumb question, not that I've not asked dumb questions in our chat already, but is it easier to write poetry because it's shorter than a short story?
Well, it's just very different, I think. I don't really write poetry. What I write is I write a kind of light verse thing, and that's I would never call myself a poet because because I'm not. And I love reading poetry, and I love reading writers like John Ashbery or Lisa Robertson people whose gift for abstraction just amazes me. I have not got that gift. What I write is very narrative. It's very kind of story driven, and I think this comes from having heard my father relentlessly, endlessly, proudly recite the shooting of Dan McGrew and the cremation of Sam McGee as I was growing up. It just, I don't know, it kind of got into me. That's, and I've never been able to shake it somehow. So if I'm struggling too much with anything, I don't necessarily force myself to continue. One thing I do know is that if I have to spend too long with it, it's not going to work.
It's not
going to
happen, yeah.
Yeah, and just best to set it aside and start again.
Do you have a drawer full of these things?
I have several hard drives full of these things. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Lots and lots of that, yeah.
But when you read something that you've written, say, 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Which I can't think of the last time I did that, but.
But so some of these stories are older, right?
Oh, yes, yeah. Yes. Yes, certainly. That is so, yes. Yeah. Yeah, they are. Some of them are that, yeah.
But
yeah,
what is
in
it
this
like,
case, yeah.
What is it like to reread yourself?
Well, I don't know. I mean, this is a very specific case. And what happened, I wouldn't have done this, but I was kind of fishing around for an agent. I don't have an agent presently, and I think maybe that's probably a good thing. For some reason, I took it into my head that if I had one, things would be better for me.
These
little
look up, right?
Weird moments.
Sure.
And so I pressed a friend into action who put me in touch with her agent, who's a good Canadian agent. And she represents both children's writers and adult people. And she said, well, what have you got you can send me? And I said, well, I don't really know. Not much. I have all these Christmas stories. And she said, oh, well, Stuart McLean did very well with those Christmas stories. And I said, well, you know, they're not really Dave and Morley kinds of Christmas stories. And she said, oh, send them anyway. So I did. And a few days later, she contacted me and said, nope, can't do anything with these. But by that time, I'd done the work of putting them together. So I thought, well, I might as well see if I can find somebody who will be interested. It occurred to me that because they were of this place, that I should find a regional publisher, a local publisher. And Talon Books, you know, very venerable, said that they would do them. So that's when I began to tinker with them. And what it was in some ways like... Yeah, it was a little bit like reading a journal in some ways. I talk about this in the introduction to the book. It was kind of like reading journals of the plague years in some ways, because I was writing for a very specific moment and in a very specific city, and so I would allude to things that were of the moment. Some of those I let remain, and others I turfed or brought up to date a little bit. So it had that about it for sure. And I was able to remember, of course, all the various circumstances surrounding the writing of those stories, the personal circumstances, who my partner might have been. There haven't been that many. What romantic involvement I might have had at the time, or where I was living, or any of those kinds of things. I have had a lot of addresses. I don't think there's much of... wide circulation or wide interest in that kind of stuff. But for me personally, it was, and I wasn't with the original stories, I wasn't necessarily unhappy with the writing. Sometimes there were some moments when I would look away, but I've usually been pretty lucky with my editors who haul me back from my excesses.
The thing about this book, and then I'm sure people will read this years from now, and because the neighborhood is changing so much, mm-hmm. and see it as a, I don't know, time capsule is the wrong word, but they'll get a flavor of the what it was.
Oh well, maybe if they do, that's great. I mean, if I had I set out to write a book about the West End,
like it would a memoir have been, would have been different.
Well,
right?
it would have been very much more West End specific. As it is, I just have a lot of passing references, but a lot of stuff I don't describe or touch on at all that would be important to West End history, of course, and to gay life in the West End especially.
Yeah.
There are occasional references to clubs. There's nothing, for instance, to say about a pride parade, or there's no mention made of, I don't know, Little Sisters or of any of the and that's not deliberate exclusion. That's just because it wasn't there in the original story. It wasn't germane. I wasn't trying to write something about the West End that was comprehensive. The stories are character driven. They're not driven by neighborhood or by time of year.
Or history. Right?
Or history. Yeah. Well, in some ways by history.
Yeah. I cannot tell you what a pleasure it is to meet you. And to get.
Are you wrapping up now?
Well, I think you have to go, don't you?
Oh, I do.
I'd love to. I mean, I could talk all afternoon with you.
It's been fun. Thank you so much for having me.
And it's been such a pleasure, as I said, to meet you and to get to talk to you about this book, because it's a very special book. And I can't urge people to pick it up and urge people enough to pick it up.
Yes, you can.
Well, then I will. Pick it
go
up.
Ahead, urge.
Thank you for doing this.
My great pleasure. Thank you so much.
I Saw Three Ships is the title of the book, West End Stories by Bill Richardson. It's published by Talon Books. Bill Richardson joined me in person here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plantin.